You ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Good morning. Good morning. I call to order the meeting of the UTEMCO Board of Directors. The date is July 21st, 2016, and the time is now 11:03. I'd like to welcome our two newest directors, Ray Nixon and Ray Rothrock, in here for the first time. As is customary, you get a small token of our appreciation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As Bruce told me, that's the last gift I'll ever get.
Is this like a tip to ensure promptness or something?
Thank you very much.
Have joined the conference.
And Ray and Ray, so this is going to be easy, same first names. You guys want to say hello and introduce yourself for a moment?
Sure. I introduced myself last time, but I live in California, Portola Valley, Silicon Valley since 1981, Texas Aggie, 77, MIT, Masters in Nuclear, and HBS in 88, and I'm partner emeritus of Venrock, did a lot of cybersecurity, 15 deals, and I've been on a bunch of public boards and stuff. I'm thrilled to be here and to contribute what I can to earning a good return for the kids.
Right. Thank you. Right.
We've already put Ray Rothrock to work helping us originate deals. Some venture capital deals. So,
I'm Ray Nixon. I married with 4 kids, 10 grandkids, the 11th on the way. Excited about that. I went to school, both undergrad and grad school, here at UT. I'm now running as the managing partner of a firm called Barrow Hanley, where we manage about $96 billion of equity and fixed income for clients around the globe. All of those are, for the most part, institutional, a few high net worth, in the billion-dollar high net worth area. I'm thrilled to be here and hope I can contribute to UTEMCO's results. And look forward to working with all of you.
Right. Well, thank you. And look, I've gotten to know both of you a little bit through this process, and we couldn't pick two more outstanding individuals. And what I really appreciate is you're both deeply committed to A&M and University of Texas, and in combination with great investing skills, different styles, venture capital versus the equity world. And so I think that you guys are going to be incredibly valuable to this organization. With the ultimate goal is to generate as much return as we can for the kids of the state of Texas. So thank you guys very much for coming on board. Really appreciate it. Any other discussion?
Well, I just want to mention that our meetings are open to the public. They are audio cast. They are recorded. We have a guest, David Rejeno, Government Affairs, A&M, joining us for the first time. We also have a reporter, Tara Hamilton, with Financial Investment News here, and who I may have a colleague that's on the phone. So welcome. I don't know if there's anyone else, Kay, on the phone that may be representing any of the media, but you never know. Just always a reminder that all our meetings are open to the public.
Great. And I want to make sure, Steve, Kyle, and Lee, are you there on the phone?
I'm here. Kyle Bass here. Steve Hicks here.
Okay. Lee? All right, Lee is done. Okay. Do we know?
We're told.
I'm sorry, I was on mute. Lee Hobson here as well.
Okay, thanks, Lee. All right. Okay.
Got everybody.
The voice from above. All right. The first item on the agenda for discussion and appropriate action is the minutes of the May 5th, 2016 meeting. Are there any comments or changes to the minutes? If not, may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second, Mr. Chairman.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are approved. The next item on the agenda relates to committee assignments for Director Nixon. There is a resolution in tab 2 appointing Director Nixon to the Risk, Compensation, and Policy Committees. Is there any discussion related to these committee assignments? If not, may I have a motion to approve the committee assignments?
Move approval, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The resolution
Aye.
Is approved. Thank you, Ray. I think you're going to enjoy all of those committees, especially the compensation committee. Yes, you have. Next is the Endowment and Operating Funds Update Report. Bruce, please present the update, tab 3.
Yes, sir. Tab 3, page 2, page 14 in Diligent. I'll try to hit some summaries for the total fund, but reserve most of the time for my colleagues to talk about their portfolios. The summary page, page 2, 14 in Diligent, the numbers here are through May, and the very top number, the minus 10 basis points for the endowments, slightly bad news, but through June we've got slightly good news, which is June was a positive month, so for the 10 months through June, the PUF was up 12%, and the JEF is up 28%. Now, one of your ex-colleagues, Clint Carlson, always cautioned me never talk about mid-month results. What I will say is for the first 3 weeks of July, equity markets are up. So, Mr. Nixon, you may be running $100 billion now, not 96. So we look forward to that. If we look at the longer-term returns on the endowments, the numbers move a little bit. The 3 years at 5.67, not 4.93. 5 years up a little above 5. The 10-year didn't move. Versus the policy portfolio, there is positive value add, but we're still negative this year, and my colleagues will talk to that. We have not been hitting the objective, the primary objective of the 5%, which represents the distribution rate plus inflation. Over the longer term, we've been keeping up with a global 60-40 stock bonds, but the U.S. has been particularly strong over the last number of years. On the ITF, again, for the 10 months, we're up 1%. But listen, there's more red ink on this page than any of us would prefer. Looking down at the peer, our returns versus peers, what I would note is that, and this is just through March, for the 1 year ending, we're just shy of median, which is where we would be for the last 10 years. We've been closer to the third quartile, kind of the 75th percentile, 3 and 5 years. So during the bull markets, as we've talked about, we've lagged. When things are kind of not great, you know, or kind of even, in fact, not good, we tend to do better than peers. And, in fact, I'm beginning to get snippets, anecdotes of how people have done in June. Calendar year June, we're up a couple percentage points. I know of some really good institutional investors' endowments that are down a couple points. So we really won't get all these results until the October-November time frame. But I think relative to other endowments, we're holding up well. On the next page, these numbers don't change a lot. We're running just under $35.5 billion. And on the next page, our exposures, the $25.6 billion that's in endowments, 9.5% in investment grade fixed income, 7.3% is the long only. That includes the liquidity reserve. The $573 million really are the global macro hedge funds. We still have 8% in credit-related fixed income, a little more in hedge funds. The private book runs down. In real estate, we're up to 6.4% in private real estate, $1.6 billion. The REIT book, we've been bringing it down, we'll continue to bring it down. Natural resources, that 6% includes the gold and public equity, natural resource-related public equity. We're just shy of 9% in natural resources-related private investments. We'll go in more detail on that. We've got just over 43% in developed country public equity, 12.5% of that's long only. Just under 20% of that's hedged, 11.4% of that is private. That includes the venture book as well as the non-venture developed country private equity. Finally, we have just over 15% in emerging markets. Most of that's public equity, a little bit in hedge funds, and the private equity emerging books, just over $1 billion. If we look at the columns, the investment styles, private investments, 34.6%, hedge 27.8%, long only 37.6%.
Bruce, what's the current allocation to gold?
2.5.
It's probably up to about 2.5 now. Uzi, do you know what the...
In absolute terms, what's the...
675 million?
Yeah, a little less than 700 million.
Okay, all right. Thanks.
Hey, Bruce, let me ask you a question, too, back on page 2. You have in here actual versus CPI plus 5%.
Yes, sir.
Is there any particular reason why you put that in there?
Yes, sir. That is really the ultimate objective of the endowment, which is to earn the distribution rate, which is 5% plus inflation. The kind of holy grail of endowment is to meet current needs plus keep the corpus whole for future generations. So that's the 5 plus inflation. So we talk about value add versus benchmarks because arguably that's what staff has most control over. We look at how we perform versus other indices, you know, other portfolios, whether it's 60-40 or we have some information in here about an S&P only or a bonds only or even a Bridgewater all weather. But ultimately, if in my view, if we were to pick one single metric, which over the long term we want to achieve, it's the distribution rate plus inflation. Let me jump to page 11, 23 in Diligent. I always find this kind of interesting because what this does is it looks at different asset classes, different markets. And this, again, is the May year-to-date. Had we been prescient, we would have put all our money in the Russian stock market, and we would have earned 8.5%. The S&P was quite strong at 8.1, and gold did real well. Bonds did well. European stock market didn't do so well. China didn't do so well, and broad commodities didn't do so well. And so we were kind of break-even-ish during this period, and you can see some asset classes were up and some were down, but it just gives you a sense of the market. If I jump ahead to page 26 in Diligent, page 14, this was a point that Keith Brown had mentioned in the Risk Committee or Policy Committee meeting. We look a lot at the up-down capture. And this is, we look at, since UTIMCO was formed, the months where either the global stock market or the U.S. stock market was up, how much was it up, and what was our portfolio up? And in those months where the stock markets were up, our portfolio tended to be up about two-thirds, 60%, 61 to 66% of what the global markets were up or the U.S. stock market was up. In those months where the stock markets were down, we were down about 36 to 41%. So we look at up-down capture. Obviously, we'd love to capture 100% of the ups and 0% of the downs. We're not that good. But if we can capture more of the ups and less than the downs, we like that. Jumping to page 29 in Diligence, page 7. And by the way, if there are any, if I'm jumping over any pages that anybody has any questions about, please stop me. Again, I thought that more of the what's going on in the portfolio would come to light when my colleagues talk about their individual parts of the book. But from a top-down perspective, page 17 in the paper version, 29 in Diligent, in the middle, this talks about, you know, where we've added value or, as the case may be, where we have not. And as we talked about last time, the big detractor in value has been our long-only book. And it's been really focused in one particular stock. It's had a lot to do with it, Valiant. And the Chinese market has been down, and our manager has done better than the market, but that's weighed on us. And Amanda Hopper, in Susan Chin's absence, took us through a lot of that detail back in May. And Amanda made sure that Susan was here in this meeting to provide more detail. The hedge fund book is slightly positive, but the word slightly has been new. Usually it's been incredibly positive versus the benchmarks, and Ryan will take us through more of that. The privates, that's kind of noise. It's hard to know until all the numbers come in. We'll be getting the June quarter-end marks in July and August. We won't get I don't think we have the March benchmarks in yet. I could be wrong on that, but it's so lagged, it's so delayed that to a certain extent that there's a lot of noise in that. We're not doing a lot of tactical. On the next page, I won't go through a lot of the detail, but where we're underweight, it tends to be in some of the public equities because we're overweight in the private equity. So if we're overweight in emerging market private equity, we're underweight in emerging market public equity. So that just creates a little bit of noise.
Yes, sir. Bruce, what is the other?
That's the 27 basis points. That's what I was just describing. We're a little underweight in. So if you flip to the next page, it's the
per policy.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
All right.
These are kind of tactical allocations. So
okay.
If you look
got
on the
it.
Next
All
page,
right. Sorry.
Down at the bottom, we're 0.6% overweight in emerging market private equity. We're to balance that off. We're 0.6% underweight in emerging market public equity. Well, emerging market public equity is kind of up, so that underweight has subtracted 5 or 6 basis points. You see the same thing in DCE, developed country equity. And because of the lags in reporting on the private equity, they're not balancing each other out yet. So that's why I call it kind of noise. That's kind of the summary I wanted to give on the top down. And what I'd like to do is ask Russ Camphy to begin on page 25 of the paper version, page 37 in Diligent, and kind of walk you through our 9 or 10 sub-portfolios to give you a better sense of kind of what's under the hood, what's really going on.
Great. Thanks, Bruce. So 37 in Diligent, 25 in paper. I'd like to direct you in the upper left-hand corner to the value-add row. We've had good long-term experience, but this last year has been very rough. There's no other way to put it. Most of that was concentrated in the May, June, July 2015 time period. In fact, if you look at our fiscal year-to-date, we're 1.1% behind the benchmark. If you look at our calendar year-to-date, 40 basis points behind the benchmark, and if you actually take, this is through 531 that I was just remarking on, if you actually take our calendar year-to-date through yesterday, we're up 50 basis points. So things are turning around. You take a look at, we have moved some capital between our internal portfolio and a couple of our external managers that we have really the highest conviction in, and we think that they have a heightened global opportunity set. So far, that's been working. We moved some money in April. We moved some money again in July. Those things have been turning around. And you can see, if you're here 3 months ago, you've seen the internal book 30% of the portfolio, now it's 27. And we've added to Brandywine and Colchester, as you see in the lower left-hand corner. Moving on to page 38, differences between our portfolio and the benchmark. You can see that we have a slightly lower duration than the benchmark by 0.3, while at the same time the yield to maturity of the overall book is almost twice the benchmark, with an average rating only slightly less than 1 notch lower. If you move over to the upper right-hand corner, you'll see our geographical exposure. Our largest overweight is to the U.S. market at the current time. I'm sure all of you are familiar with some very low yields that are on offer in the rest of the G3 and G7. You can see that our largest underweight is to the Asia-Pacific aggregate countries. That negative 12 was actually masking a 17% underweight to Japan, where our managers on the whole find very little to no value. We do have a fairly large overweight to the emerging markets of 11.3%. 5% of that is in Mexico, with another 2% each in Brazil and Malaysia at the current time.
Hey, Russ, have you done the attribution analysis to explain the underperformance over the last year?
You know, Keith, largely the outperformance came from emerging market currency.
The underperformance.
And the overweight to emerging market currency at the same time you had, I'm sorry, the overweight to that, at the same time you had underweights to those G3 markets that I was talking about, largely for Europe and Japan. So if you look at the currency exposure in the lower left-hand corner, you can see what I was just referring to. We continue to have an overweight to emerging market currencies, that 13.7% overweight, largely made up of 5% to Mexico, 2% to Brazil, 1.5% to Chile, Malaysia, South Africa, and 1.3% overweight to India. At the same time, we have a fairly substantial underweight, as I mentioned before, to Europe at 7.5%. Finally, looking at sector exposure, you have overweights to both the Treasury and sovereign and the corporate sectors that are offset by underweights to government-related. You can think of that as a government agency sector and the securitized sector. A large proportion of that is U.S. agency mortgages, which have very little value currently, primarily due to the fact that it's overrun that market with their core holdings. So that's the portfolio. If you have any questions, let me answer them.
Would it be fair to say that we have more of a value orientation? You got the internal book and our managers, and that sometimes momentum can kind of influence markets, but...
Yes, I that's a fair statement, Bruce, although I think the way that our managers, between the internal portfolio and the external portfolio, go about it in different ways. Mm-hmm. Certainly they look for value. Certainly our global and global ex-U.S. managers look for value in real yields around the world, and they look to extract that, and it may come from the bond holdings and through rates themselves, or it may come through movements in foreign exchange.
So it looks like your underperformance is really based on, you know, a couple of managers where you've got pretty big allocations to it.
Well, Jeff, let me make a subtle point to that. That this is true. But, you know, we've tried to keep a balance within the portfolio because we really do like all of our managers. But, yes, you know, Brandywine, who is our longest global manager, has had a tremendous record over a very long time. And, in fact, I was there last year in March meeting with them. And I told him at the time, you know what? If I was green, I would give you all of our money because they've done such a fabulous job. And you know what? They've had their worst 12 months since we had them.
So we've only got about what, five managers, four managers?
We have five, including the internal book.
And so Brandywine, we've been with them for eight and a half years since March of 2008. They've added 340 basis points since inception, which, Ray, I think in the fixed income world is pretty good.
It's off the charts.
Now, this past 1 year, they've lost 6.3%, which is a huge loss. But even with that loss, they've added 340 basis points annually in 8.5 years.
And that's why we've been adding money back to Brandywine now. It's a time when somebody's down. If they're still following the process and they haven't forgotten how to manage money, you add that.
The biggest Brandywine. What's their AUM?
You know, I can't give you the exact figure, Jeff. It's over $50 billion.
I know that. I say it's bigger than so, that.
Ask that
it's like a couple hundred.
They're very large manager.
They're big.
Very accomplished in the global arena.
Hey, Russ, let me ask you a question in terms of just the process of managing internally. You've got the investment grade credit, and you have the internal U.S. nominal.
Yes, sir.
Are those run by two separate teams?
No, they're not. Really, the way to think about it is there are two of us that are involved on the internal portfolio.
Is Harlan here? Is he on?
Harlan's
out this week.
He's out this week. There's my colleague, Marlon Dove, who looks over the credit portions of the portfolio. There's myself, who looks over the non-credit portions of the portfolio. We sit next to each other and, you know, hit each other every day.
And they do.
We do. We throw things back and forth. And then I oversee the mix between those two. That's the way we've been functioning now for the last 15 years.
Do you just compliment you. Your internal investment grade credit numbers are outstanding for 2 years.
Well,
you guys ought to go on business.
It's great. That's very generous.
Remember, you're on Team UTIMCO.
Thank you very much, and I'll pass that along to Harlan. We, a long time ago, decided that we want to have a very conservative credit portfolio. And there's going to be times when we're going to lag the benchmark because we are conservative. However, as I think Uzi would point out to you and Bruce would substantiate as well, we are very countercyclical, and we're a very good diversifier to not only the rest of the fixed income portfolio but the overall portfolio because of that attribute. That's our style, and it's worked well.
I'm going to be in trouble time-wise. Eddie, do you want us to just skip the REIT portfolio?
I would love to skip the REIT portfolio.
Thank you, John.
I think if we look at the REITs, the portfolio returns across all time periods have been extremely disappointing from a value-add perspective. And the reality is that all of our managers have contributed to the disappointing returns. And particularly one of our newer mandates that we put in place in the last 18 months, down nearly 20% this year, which really drags down the portfolio as a whole. This is a manager actually that we have been redeeming and will be out of. We're out of as of the end of June. The underperformance across our managers is not just isolated to one or two things. It's really they've underperformed based on geographic exposure. They've underperformed on stock selection. If we look at the U.S., quite frankly, it's poor stock selection. Many of the REIT assets.
I screwed up time-wise. The portfolio's not done well. Eddie inherited it. The good news is over 7 years, we've made 10.6%. Two things. One, we're kind of taking this out of the policy portfolio, collapsing it into the overall portfolio. We probably won't have as much REIT exposure, A. B, to the extent we have REIT exposure, it may very well be passive.
If the managers are all underperforming, what does that tell us?
Our managers tend to be very value-driven. And REITs have, in the low-interest rate environments, REITs have been an alternative for many bond retail investors or just investors in general. REITs, for that reason, are trading at significant premiums to their underlying asset values, and our managers haven't seen that value. So they've been looking for pockets where there has been REITs that are trading at discounts to the underlying value of the real estate. And those plays have not kept up. And so our manager's conservative bias towards value names in an upmarket, the REITs have outrun them, quite frankly. And so they keep saying, we don't see the value. It's too expensive. We can't get value. And so they haven't kept up. And we found that we have not been able to generate the alpha that we expect of ourselves and the real estate team.
If you just the 7 year is 10.6, the 3 is 1.8, the 5 is 3.4. I mean, they've had a huge hit. I mean, long 7 years ago, they must have been generating very high returns. So, did we switch managers?
We did. So we had a relationship with that we put in place in the last 18 months. That, as I mentioned starting off, has this year nearly a negative 20%, which has struck down returns across the board. Particularly,
we were positive
in the longer data horizons, and that has changed in the last.
Anyway, suffice to say, it's an area of the portfolio that you're looking at.
And we're killing.
and you're moving quickly away.
We are redeemed.
We are. Okay. Where we have added value is in private real estate, which we'll talk about, and which is where we feel like we can continue to.
Good.
And I apologize. I didn't time things well. So natural resources.
On the natural resources book, page 40, you can see we're coming out of what was a historic drawdown. 1 year returns on the top right. You can see 21% down. 600 basis points.
If you don't mind, could you speak up? The people on the phone can barely hear whoever's talking right now.
So the returns for the natural resources equity book are down 21%. That's 600 basis points below our benchmark. Over the quarter, we'll note that the equity portfolio has outperformed the natural resource equity benchmark by 900 basis points, and the equity book is up 26% over that quarter. On the commodities book, which is at the bottom of that chart, we're down 24% year-over-year. That's 900 basis points below our commodities benchmark. Over the quarter, that portfolio, the commodities portfolio, is up 13%, which is flat to our benchmark. You'll note on the bottom left, after some internal analysis late in 2015, in December 2015, we decided to underweight commodities significantly and overweight the subsectors of our equity portfolio based on the opportunity set and fundamental valuation. That overweight and underweight is now overweight 150 basis points in public equities. And over the quarter, that equity book has outperformed our commodity book by 1,300 basis points. On the right, on the bottom, you can see our two adds. We added $200 million to our midstream portfolio in December 2015. That is up 15%, which is slightly lagging our benchmark for our natural resource equities. The $130 million that we added to metals and mining is up 37%, which is 2,000 basis points ahead of our equities, natural resource equities benchmark. And so we repositioned based on a fundamental basis, and we think some of those decisions are working out well. You saw it over the last quarter. But it's a historic drawdown, and we're digging out of that hole.
Yeah, so just to summarize that, our benchmark is 50-50 between equities and commodities. So what we did was we sold the commodities, went into equities. You can see the dollar figures. We're $1 billion of public equities, $300 million of commodities, so big overweight to the equities relative to the commodities, and the timing of that decision, as Billy said, has added value add that you don't see on this page. So we're hopeful that in combination with recovering the equities market will get us back.
So on the detail we received from Kay Wells on the BlackRock, they're like 1 month down 11%. I realize it's just a short period, but did we buy high or did we buy low?
We bought when you look at the aggregate market, it was priced to NAV, but we think it's a pretty good NAV, about 0.9.
Okay.
They ran pretty heavily in the first, call it, 5 months of the year. That May number was down 11%. June was back up 12%. It's a volatile space.
That makes you nervous.
There's a lot of living room. There's
Okay.
And once again, Bruce, natural resources, broad category. What's in it?
So this is public equities.
Right.
So it includes pretty much any subsector you'd want to talk about. So it's E&P, it's metals and mining, it's MOPs.
The benchmark is heavily weighted to the large integrated oil companies. The public equity benchmark is heavily weighted to the large integrated oil companies. Our particular portfolio is very diversified.
Yes. So we're underweight all the big cap names, and as you know, during the drawdown, they drew down less. The mid-cap names that we were exposed to that do much better over the long term, in the short term during the drawdown, did worse. So it's a higher beta portfolio, but we're starting to get that positive beta. During this last year, at our biggest drawdown in the equity book, we were down about 12% on a relative basis, 12 or 13%. We're now recovered almost half of that, or more than half of that. So over the last 3 months, that performance has come back in spades.
So it's going to get better than negative 20.
Well, if you can tell me what's going to go on in the year going forward, I could answer that question.
It's going to be flat. How's that? Commodities are going to be flat.
Yeah.
So what kind of return will we generate in a flat environment?
So I can't tell you what the absolute return would be in a flat environment, Jeff. I don't know what the equity market would do in a flat environment. Probably wouldn't do much. As you know, the resource equity names are highly correlated to underlying commodity prices.
Okay.
So next page, the developed markets public equity portfolio. In the one-year period through the end of May, unfortunately, the portfolio generated negative actual returns as well as negative value add, losing 8.8%, which is more than the MSCI World loss of 4%. Amanda reviewed the underperformance reasons for underperformance in detail through February at the last board meeting. And the performance for the quarter ended May was in line with the benchmark, so the reasons for the underperformance basically stay the same. The main detractors were poor relative and absolute performance by two of our U.S. managers, and this was slightly offset by strong relative performance from one of our global managers. An update on fiscal year-to-date through the end of June, which is not on this page. The portfolio has declined about 5% versus a benchmark return of 2.3%. So June was also a challenging month. The main detractors were, again, two of our U.S. managers, but also a few of our other core managers experienced underperformance. The appreciation in the yen from 120 to 103 during the fiscal year also hurt us, since our yen exposure is about 50% hedged. As a reminder, we were about 90% hedged through last year, and then during the first quarter of the fiscal year, reduced this to a 50% hedge ratio. And then lastly, during June, Brexit had a negative impact on a few of our managers with Europe and UK exposure. Over the 3, 5, and 7 year periods, the actual and relative performance has been stronger. However, we are disappointed with the recent performance and have been reviewing the portfolio to determine potential adjustments. You can see on the bottom left box our activity during the fiscal year. We added a new Europe manager, Albert Bridge, long-only concentrated Europe-focused manager based in London, a new U.S.-focused manager, Hound, and then we also added some capital to two existing managers, a co-investment vehicle with Ashe and then Stellium after a period of underperformance. And then we also redeemed from an activist manager and trimmed our exposure to several other managers. Portfolio now has 13 managers, roughly allocated one-third each between U.S. global and developed ex-U.S., and liquidity continues to be high with 83% of the portfolio that can be liquidated within 9 years. Next page is emerging markets portfolio. In the one-year period ended May, the portfolio generated negative actual returns but positive value add. Portfolio lost 13.7%, which was less than the MSCI EM loss of 17.5%. The largest detractors in our portfolio were our a Middle East manager that we have redeemed from and our Africa manager, and this was offset by positive contributions from our two Brazil managers, our China manager, our Russia manager, and a few of our Asia managers. For fiscal year-to-date through June, which is not on this page, the portfolio has returned about 6.8%, which is better than the benchmark return of 3%, same contributors and detractors. We've seen a bit of recovery in EM, as Bruce alluded to earlier, with the benchmark up 20% since the lows in January. Brazil index is up over 75%. Russia index is up over 45%, with about half to two-thirds of those gains driven by currency. Over the 3 and 5 year periods, actual performance has been about flat, but better than the MSCI EM performance of negative 5% annualized. And then over the 7 year period, the actual performance has been about 6.5% annualized. During the fiscal year, you can see the left bottom box, our funding and redemption activity. We terminated a prior Middle East and Africa manager and put that capital toward two new managers, one focused on the Middle East and a different manager focused on Africa. We rotated global emerging markets exposure from a few diversified managers to a more concentrated global emerging markets manager, and then we added capital to one of our active Asia managers and added a new China-focused manager. And then we finally added some capital to our Brazilian managers, as that market was very attractively valued at the beginning of the fiscal year.
On slide 31 and page 43 of Diligent, the performance table shows the LCC portfolio's seven-year return of 7.4% and 450 basis points of value add. Then similar to the other portfolio charts, it declines as you move to the left to more recent time periods. This is typical when taking the snapshot late cycle, and especially during a period of negative performance. The same chart at the peak in 2013 is upward sloping, and this paints the sine wave of rolling returns you often hear me refer to. So in the last year, our managers have been operating in an environment where global equities were down 5%, high yield down 2%, other funded funds down 6%, and we were down 4%, with 200 basis points of value add. Fiscal year to date through June, we're down 2.3% with about 25 basis points of positive value add. Our managers take 2 to 3 year views on their investments, and the last year has had high uncertainty in commodities, China, slowing global growth, negative interest rates, and most recently Brexit. We partner with long-term fundamental investors, not traders, and when discounts change rapidly and fundamentals are mixed, our managers struggle in choppy markets. But let me be clear, some of our managers have been generating negative alpha. It's happened before, and it's likely to happen again. We constantly analyze our attribution, focusing on what are the drivers and the quality of our returns. Sometimes losses are broad-based, and others they are concentrated. Right now, they are concentrated. About 85% of the portfolio is down between 1% to 2% on average and represents about a third of the 4% loss. It's the four managers in our top 10 relationships that represent about 15% or more than $1.5 billion that are down an average of 14%, but within a tight range of 12 to 16%. These four managers accounted for two-thirds of the 4% loss, and I'd like to give you more detail as to why. We've gone through their investment processes, organizations, and portfolios and made different decisions accordingly. Two we added capital, one we held, and one we're reducing. So the worst performer is a long-short equity manager down 16% due to several misassessments of long investments across healthcare, energy, and financials, which more than offset profits from the short side. It's their second worst drawdown in their almost 20-year history and the worst experience of our 12-year partnership with them. However, this magnitude of their long-short alpha spread has occurred only three other times, all of which were made back within 18 months. In addition, they made favorable changes to their team and are in the process of rebuilding exposures with new names. So we added $50 million. Next, our largest macro manager was down 15% in this one-year period. This mandate targets an 18% volatility, so it's less than a 2-standard deviation event. The bulk of the losses were in equity markets, where they were both net long during a sell-off, as well as the relative country selection by being long certain cheaper countries and short more expensive markets. And the spread continued to widen. They were also short the yen on oversold conditions, which has only continued with the market's flight to safety. So after understanding their current positioning and being an early call with a limited amount of capacity, we added $140 million. Next, another long-short equity manager was down 13%. This has been the second best performing LCC mandate over the last 5 years, compounding at 13% net of fees and inclusive of this drawdown. The losses were almost exclusively due to MLPs and energy, an area where the manager has significant expertise. Because of a board seat on a highly publicized takeover target, they were locked up and prevented from selling. We still have more than $400 million invested with this manager and have taken no action and still retain conviction. Finally, we have a long-standing relationship with the multi-strategy manager down 12%. They are flat in the calendar year, so this means the losses were in the second half of last year, and they were spread across several equity and credit event-driven positions that screen as value and have been out of favor. We've reduced position size and continue a close dialogue. What else have we done during the period? As you can see on the left-hand side of the slide, fiscal year-to-date, we've had about 12% turnover in the portfolio in 9 months. We've redeemed $1.3 billion. At the same time, we've been actively seeking capacity in our high-conviction managers that can both short stocks as well as macro that we think will do better going forward. So the $1.1 billion of additions. So both these actions combined to raise $121 million for distributions and upgrade the portfolio. Finally, I'd like to point out the drop in our net exposure at the bottom of the page. In August, it was 52%, and now in May, it was 24%. Most of this drop was macro managers shorting foreign currencies against the dollar, as well as interest rates, given the more recent significant rally. So I'll pause for any questions, and then I'd like to walk you through three quick slides about the role the hedge fund portfolio plays that Bruce asked me to put together.
Just real, when you look at those, I think it was four out of the top ten. In addition to all those macroeconomic things, did they have similar portfolios? Are they playing follow me? Were they in the same, holding the same assets?
We were diversified, and it was remarkably impressive how many different ways our managers found ways to lose money. It's anomalous. Kind of the different sine waves are kind of intersecting.
Yeah.
And but then we go individual and bottom up, and then we added where we had the conviction that this is an opportunity going forward. And then others, particularly if they sold their positions where they were wrong. Like, for example, several merger deals have broken up, and those losses were just crystallized. So they got it wrong this year. They get it right more often than they do get it wrong. And so we didn't add there because there wasn't an opportunity.
But you couldn't, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. What's the correlation, Ben, of the LCC portfolio to S&P?
Yep. We look at both correlation and beta. The correlation long-term has been in the 0.6 range over shorter-term periods. It can be as high as 0.7. Occasionally you'll get 0.8. However, our volatility is half to a third. And so when you blend those together, our beta is very consistent at 0.3. So we've spent a lot of time over this decision of the trade-off to lower the correlation versus leave it high and then have a lower volatility. And particularly in the crisis, we spent a lot of time. And basically, our assessment has been and continues to be that if we took action to focus on managers to lower the correlation top-down, we don't think we'd make enough. We think we'd give up several hundred basis points of returns. And so we watch it closely because if our volatility does spike, we're going to feel that higher correlation. So that's why it's not uncorrelated. We've never attested that. It's just it's less correlated. But it kind of, ebbs and flows.
Because of the volatility, it's lower beta.
Yes.
So a dollar move in the S&P is a 30-cent move.
Yes.
In the hedge fund portfolio.
And that it's like clockwork, 0.3, and that's by design because 0.5, we have enough risk in the private equity portfolio and the public market portfolio. We're not looking for that to be the role the hedge fund portfolio plays. And then zero, we don't think we'd make enough. So on the slides, slide one shows the cumulative 5-year returns, not annualized. Since our
hey, Ryan.
Yep.
I'm sorry. Before we move on, this is Kyle. I just want to ask a question. As we start changing investment policy, or as we make different policy decisions, and mandates come from above for you to either increase or decrease, let's say the LCC book, do those decisions? How do you make those decisions? Are those ratable decisions, or are those decisions made kind of idiosyncratically?
We discuss these at portfolio positioning committee as well as investment committee as well as the senior investment team meetings. And every part of the portfolio competes against everything else. And so, if we're allowed the flexibility like we've had to be overweight or underweight, we may choose to do that. But we know that we're going to own that decision. And so I think part of what the slides show is, we might like to be a little bit of overweight hedge funds here, but, completely depends, and we just kind of go day by day.
We've, I think, if I remember correctly, we're at around 27.5, 27.8 LCC at the end of May.
Yep.
And, the current policy proposal for FY17 is to end the year at 25. We have certain projections that our privates may end up even higher than the 36 policy. So we've already been talking in those forums that Ryan mentioned about various implementation scenarios. And do we bring down the hedge fund book? Do we bring down other books? And if so, how do we do it? Because, you know, particularly with the hedge fund book, but even in other books, there are certain notice periods and redemption windows. And, you know, just real life, and in the long-only book, there are the same thing. There's certain soft lockups, hard lockups. And so there's certain, you know, there's not only what do we want to do from a investment kind of market perspective, but from a real world, how do we manage that? So we're trying to stay way ahead of that, looking at different scenarios and understanding how we would implement that. Because what we don't want to do is at the last minute find ourselves in a bind and have to take money from the places we'd least like to take money from.
So just quickly on
that, Bruce, that was the gist of the question. Basically, if you have a mandate to say lower exposure from 27.5 to 25, is that a decision you'll make ratably across the book? Or from what I've seen, it seems to be kind of leaving it with your highest conviction managers and just taking it away from your low conviction managers. Is that accurate, Ryan?
Yes, that's exactly accurate. And for example, we're going through some, we've got a kind of a focus on capital allocation. How do we allocate capital? And Ryan and Mark Warner are leading that up. Everybody's participating in it. We're throwing, you know, as many ideas as we can in the hopper. We haven't kind of shaken it all out. But one idea is that, and we're beg, borrowing, and stealing these ideas from everywhere we can find. Unfortunately, we partner with great managers around the world. But kind of on a regular basis, every quarter or something, you know, who are our five favorite partners and who are our five least favorite partners, and just rigorously go through that. So, you know, we're definitely want to put some process and good analytics around it. So, again, we're staying ahead of the curve and trying to make the best decisions we can within the context of the policies and what the markets are presenting us.
Thank you.
Why do we invest in the hedge funds with so little money?
Maria
has left the conference.
$44 million, $64 million, $8 million, $10 million,
$12 million. Those are on their way out.
So what is the asset class size that we start somebody with?
You know, it's gone up over time. You know, we like to say we'd like to have a path to $200 million. That would be a 2% position in our portfolio. You know, that's where it starts to matter. We can be flexible and maybe build that over a year or two, but some hard close managers and they only offer us 50, we turn it down. So the top 10 are 42% of the portfolio.
Our participants have joined the conference.
And then there's some that are newer and we're waiting for conviction, and some that are on their way out.
Got to pace you.
Yep. So 5-year cumulative returns straight up, and LCC outperforms in most of these different periods. Where we do lag is at the peak of the bull markets. We are hedged. We feel like we're through that period. And going forward, we like the prospects, and when you add that up over time, it's very powerful. We've turned a dollar into 380 versus 220 for global equities. On the next slide, if you slice the data a different way and pick four different return regimes of minus 10 or worse bear market, a little bit down, a little bit up, and then plus 10 or better bull market, we have 162 rolling one-year periods. And similar to the endowment, we get two-thirds of the up capture on the far right and only a third of the down capture on the far left. And I think we're probably in a muted return environment in the middle, and that's where we beat, on average, straight up, regardless of the correlation or the volatility. Finally, on the third slide, if you just look at the eight worst sell-offs since 98, we show that for the market, they've ranged between down 10% and down 55%. And our returns range from down 19% to up 25%. So equities are down a lot, and we're down a little.
All right, thank you. Let me jump on to conclude the funds update. Let me jump to page 48, paper 60, diligent. Just a summary of the private portfolio. We went into a lot of detail in the May meeting. Let me just summarize, again, page 48, paper, page 60, diligent. We started the fiscal year with $8.3 billion, 32% of our portfolio in privates. We're up to $8.86 billion, 35%. We started with 24% in unfunded, $6.1 billion. That's pretty much where we are now. We've had $1.5 billion of calls through May, $1 billion in distributions, so that's the $500 million increase that's gone into the ground. We have had valuation increase of $100 million. A lot of that's come in real estate. That's where Eddie was referencing. The real estate private portfolio has done well. It's up 8.7%. The venture book's off because of some publicly traded securities that the market's backed off of. You'll remember that was an incredible 50-plus percent portfolio last fiscal year. The credit book, the developed country book, has done fine. Emerging market book, fair, because currencies weighed on that. And the resources book, in light of everything that's been going on, kind of been holding its own. So that's kind of the funds update. Again, through June, barely positive, better than barely negative, not making our 5%. Value add's been a real struggle, negative in the public book, slightly positive in the hedge fund book. Unfortunately, the word slightly's there. Private book, a lot of noise, but certainly doesn't appear to be distinguishing itself at this point. As we talked about in May, doing a lot of work on the benchmark. We have a benchmark that's a very opaque, kind of conglomerated benchmark. We have a very segmented portfolio, lots of real estate, lots of natural resources, lots of credit, very different than than what we believe is the very opaque benchmark. Having said that, we put that benchmark in place. We knew it wasn't perfect, you know, and so we're doing work on that. What I'd like to do is move, with your permission, to the operations, accounting, and reporting overview, which I think is really important. It's something that I've neglected for too long to bring to this board's attention. And so Joan and Gary, if you don't
fine.
Mind.
Before that, any comments from the board members on the operating update? Okay.
So this is tab 4. Let me kick it off by making an overview, providing some observations that Joan and Gary are too humble to make on their own, but I'm not, which is that the operations and accounting and reporting team have executed their responsibilities with extraordinary efficiency and quality and service, and they've done so with utmost security, and you'll see why that's so important. They've utilized technology in doing so, and that not only does this provide a strong foundation for UTIMCO, but I think gives us a competitive advantage, particularly as our investment activities become more complex, more global, and just increase in scope. So with that introduction, Joan and Gary, if you'll take us through the material.
All right. Thanks, Bruce. Our presentation today is meant to give you a brief and very broad overview of OAR's responsibilities. So with continuing with the executive summary on page 78, which is just a diligent number, I want to emphasize how OAR is central to everything that UTIMCO does and to everyone UTIMCO interacts with. So when we interact with a lot, just for example, for the UT system offices, we certainly interact with the Office of Finance, with Terry Hall. He's probably our most significant one. We also interact with the Development Gift Planning Services, West Texas Lands, the Controller's Office, the Real Estate Office, and the Audit Office. We also interact with the Board Office, Office of General Counsel, and Governmental Relations. We have relationships with all of them. And at the institutions, each one at UT, we also have relationships with them, especially the development offices and the business offices. And then with Texas A&M University System, it's more of the Treasury Services that we work with, Maria Robinson with that one. And then internally, of course, we provide data and support for the investment staff, the risk and compliance teams, and, of course, our CEO. Other interfaces are Deloitte. Deloitte's our external auditor, and right now they're downstairs auditing the funds. It seems like they're here all the time, but they're not. And then we also have relationship with Cambridge and the external managers, of course, and other data providers. And our biggest, probably key interface has to do with our global custodian, BNY Mellon. They're so important. We want to talk about our relationship before we even get into our other critical activities that OAR does. And what, you know, Mellon is a global custodian, so they do all the other custodian things you would think they would, like settling trades and moving money around. They just do, you know, all of that stuff, corporate actions. But for us, they really are truly an extension of our staff. Because what they do for us is really, they are our official books of records. And for us, they maintain the general ledgers for us. So that means that they're going to process everything through and record everything. And with that in mind, we send them, you know, valuations for everything. They record that as well. So they are an integral part of everything that we do. And another very important part about Mellon is the fact that every day, all transactions, all holdings, all everything is downloaded to our internal data warehouse. And throughout this presentation, we're going to talk about that data warehouse because it is extremely important to us. It's an internally built warehouse, data warehouse that our IT team built in the 90s. Those daily downloads every day and are so important to us. If they fail, which they don't fail very often, it really does kind of set us back for the day's activities. So again, a very extremely important tool to us. Continuing on the next page.
Page 80 now, yes. 5 in paper.
Yes. We've listed the critical activities that OAR is responsible for, and we're going to go over those today. We've got the contributions and disbursements, the external investment manager partners, internal trading, securities, accounting for the investment funds, accounting for reporting for individual endowments, general reporting, operational due diligence, and separately invested funds.
So we're going to get started on pages 81 and 82 of the presentation of Diligent. On pages 81 and 82, it kind of highlights the activities surrounding contributions and distributions for the funds that UTMCO manages. The first item that I'm going to talk about is one that many of you may not be aware that OAR has responsibility for. In 2005, the Board of Regents gave approval to create a new operating fund, the Intermediate Term Fund. This fund replaced the fixed income fund that previously the UT system and institutions invested their operating funds in. In addition to facilitating the initial funding of all the MCC and LCC managers that are invested in this fund, a big part of that creation and transition to that new fund was the development of a system to allow for UT system and the institutions to transact their cash between their local bank accounts and the short-term fund. Our IT staff, working with the back office OAR staff and the UT system office of finance, built the cash management system. CMS allows for the individuals at the institutions to move their cash between their local bank accounts and the short-term fund. It also provides a means for facilitating cash transfers between the institutions and also the rebalancing of funds between that intermediate-term fund and the short-term fund on a monthly basis. OAR monitors the CMS system to make sure that all of the cash transactions are handled appropriately and are recorded appropriately and all the wires go out. We work with Terry very closely on his debt payments. He's very concerned that those are met in a timely fashion. So if there's any delays,
certainly help to facilitate those types of issues as they go. One of the big concerns at the time of the creation of this system was the security surrounding it, since it did allow for cash movements to external parties. In order to satisfy those concerns, the CMS system was set up on a dedicated server within the HMCO offices. An outside consultant was hired to test the security that was developed by the IT staff. And over the 10-year period, there haven't been any big security issues. And still periodically, that outside consultant does come back in and test the security just to make sure that there aren't any breaks as things develop out in the world. So now I'm going to page 82, where we talk about the ITF distributions, which are paid monthly, and the contributions and redemptions also occur monthly. Because system and each institution only have one ITF account, there really aren't that many transactions necessarily related to the ITF. But certainly that is much different for the long-term fund. It has over 12,000 unit holders or participants. The LTF serves as a private endowment donor pool, and also has several other long-term unit holder accounts. Although it varies from year to year, on average, there's about 400 new accounts that are set up, that we bring in about $200 million of additional contributions into the long-term fund. And we manage the quarterly processes for the buy-ins and the distributions for the long-term fund. Each endowment, we maintain a separate unit holder account in a subsidiary ledger, and basically it functions like a mutual fund. It's very important that we keep accurate records in those individual accounts, and as part of that, we have to watch most of the transactions or all of the transactions that come through. So if new gifts come through from the institutions, we want to make sure that they end up in the right account, so the interest is accrued to the right account, the distributions are paid to the right account, and ultimately any reporting that would go out to the donors would be correct in that respect as well. The buy-in and the distributions and any other transactions are handled in an internally built accounting system, the financial accounting system, and which we refer to as IFAS, and we'll refer to that again throughout the presentation. Another endowment fund that we calculate the quarterly distributions for is the Permanent Health Fund, and that's the state endowment that was established back in 1999 with tobacco settlement proceeds. It has 9 unit holder accounts, which mostly are UT system health-related institutions. We haven't received any new contributions into the PHF. And it's just as a reminder, the PHF and the LTF actually hold units in the General Endowment Fund. So the General Endowment Fund is the larger investment pool. PHF distributions are sent to the comptroller's office, and the comptroller's office actually makes the distributions to the ultimate beneficiaries based on some formula developed by the legislature back when the fund was initially started. Just as an interesting side note, back in 1999, the fund was actually started with $820 million of original contributions. Through the end of fiscal year 2016, it's going to have distributed over $735 million. And currently, it has a net asset value of a little over $1 billion. So in that 17-year history, it's quite impressive with what has been able to be done for the health-related institutions of the state of Texas at that time. The PUF receives daily contributions from the West Texas Lands mineral income. It's not a unitized fund, so we don't have any unit ownership to keep track of. And the payment of the distributions is actually determined, the timing of the payment of the distribution is determined by our risk management team and their communications with the Office of Finance at UT System and the Texas A&M Treasurer's Office. The PUF distribution this year was paid out over a 4-month period, so they asked that we delay it until later in the spring, and then the last payment was made on July 1st, so the full distribution has been paid as of today.
And does that distribution stay fully invested until the day it's made?
Yes.
Okay. Oops.
So now if we continue on page 83, we'll talk about a little bit of the responsibilities we have associated with external investment. Currently, there are 252 external managers. That equates to about 478 individual funds and co-investments and separately managed accounts. We coordinate the setup for all of these accounts, so they have to be set up at Mellon. And each one has a balance sheet and an income statement that would roll up into the total fund, general ledger, and balance sheet and income statement as well. Depending on the type of the account, the setup could include filling out paperwork for several foreign currencies or for foreign countries, and we also utilize several Mellon sub-custodian relationships. If there's a private investment or co-investment, it also has to be set up internally in the Burgess Private Eye System, which is our subsidiary ledger where we keep track of all of that information. That is a source for a lot of reporting that the internal private investment staff utilize, as well as a lot of the information that Bruce would request from time to time. As part of that, we have to make sure that all of the new fundings and redemptions are made on a timely basis. All private eye capital calls are met in a timely fashion, and then any receipts or distributions are handled correctly. So we have to tell Bella to take the funds in and how to allocate them to the appropriate accounts. That cash activity is only part of the activities that we perform related to external managers, though. And we also calculate or verify their management fee and incentive fee calculations to make sure the appropriate amounts are being charged, as well as other contacts that we might have with them. In addition, for the separately managed accounts, we have created internal pools or pooled accounts to facilitate for cross fund rebalancing. And prior to the formation of these pools, the PUF, the GF, and the ITF each had a separate agreement with each external manager, each individual separate manager. If rebalancing needed to occur, individual securities would have to be transferred between those fund accounts, which, depending on individual manager and how many securities they may hold, it could be quite time-consuming for the manager staff and for the back-office staff. Now that these pools occur, the PUF and the GF and the ITF hold units in one manager pooled account, and for rebalancing, we simply just sell units between the funds as opposed to transferring individual securities. I mention this because it is a very complicated and technical area from an accounting and reporting perspective, because it really it made the rebalancing process much easier from a back office and an investment standpoint. But essentially, all of that information still has to be consolidated into the individual fund, general ledgers, and accounting records. Currently, we have 35 of those accounts that we consolidate on a monthly basis.
Okay, so I'm going to continue on page 84 in Diligent and talk about internal trading. Currently, we don't have a lot of internal trading, but what we do have is a fixed income portfolio and derivatives. So unless Russ or Susan decide to really go wild, we're good with that. But all trades have to be processed, settled, and reconciled with the counterparties, of course. And then for derivatives, we certainly have to calculate the daily margin requirements and process the collateral movements. So those are just kind of the few things that we have to do with that. On the next page, we talk about securities. We mentioned earlier, of course, that we utilize that data warehouse. So within that data warehouse is a master file, and it has 56,000 securities in it. That data warehouse has had securities in there since 93, and once they go in, they never get deleted. And so that part's extremely important to us because in order to us to have our various levels of granularity in our reporting, all these securities have to have an asset type and other identifying information. And because without that, we can't do the reporting that's required. For those of you that sit on the audit and ethics, you're going to see a detailed schedule of the PUS securities, which is probably 200, 300 pages, and they're all listed out. In order for that schedule to work right, it comes back to this master file. So that keeps growing. That master file probably grows with about an average of 200 every month, and we really do have to pay attention as those go in because, really, it's trash in, trash out. So we definitely have to keep track of that.
So continuing on page 86, the first slides have kind of highlighted very briefly a good portion of the activities that we perform in the back office. And those functions provide the basis for the accounting for the investment funds. On page 86, we're kind of very briefly summarized, kind of wrapped up a lot of information in one slide, just to save you from looking at a lot of detail. But it's very important to understand that even though Mellon is considered the official books and records, back office staff is in continuous contact with them several times every workday. You know, providing instructions on the allocation of incoming and outgoing funds, talking about the accounting for any new security types or derivative types that may come through, helping resolve any reconciliation differences in manager accounts as far as valuations or trade rates, and those types of things would be just examples of how we communicate with them on a daily basis.
Let me ask you, on a percentage basis in your fixed income and equities portfolio, on a percentage basis, how much do we actually custody ourselves or with Mellon?
Public equity? We probably custody 80.
Yeah.
80.
Something. More in emerging markets and less in developed markets. More of the developed market commingled funds. The better managers require us to go to the funds.
That's right.
So that's the delta between 100 and 60 or whatever.
The fixed income book, it's 100%. And in the emerging market book, more of it because we insist on the separate accounts. So we custody all that. And I forgot about the developed country book. You're right.
What about think about 60%?
We can get the exact number for you.
Sure, I'll defer.
It's probably 60 for developed and maybe 80 for emerging.
And clearly, you always want to custody whenever you can, right?
You know, the advantage, also the advantage of those, two advantages of separate managed accounts, the custody, you know, the security level detail, and then we customize the investment guidelines. As opposed to a fund that has general investment guidelines, you know, we're along with everybody else in the fund's investment guidelines. On a separately managed account, we can customize it to exactly what we want.
And on those managed accounts, how often do you say, well, we're XYZ manager, we're going to move, and we're going to take our portfolio with us, and then you give that custodied portfolio to another manager for settlement. Does that happen very often?
It doesn't happen often because it's rare that another manager has a very similar portfolio to the manager that we're redeeming from. So we'll sometimes use a transition. If there is a lot of overlap, we'll sometimes use a transition manager to basically, instead of having the manager we're redeeming from sell the securities and having the manager that we're investing in buy the same securities to reduce the, you know, transaction cost, will help the transition manager help us. But it doesn't happen, though.
What is our commission recapture policy? When we're moving assets from one manager to another, or when they're actually just trading in the public?
I don't think we have an official.
Do we do any commission recapture at all?
We have in some of our separate account agreements the ability to direct commissions, but we usually don't. We usually let the manager determine who they want to trade with because a lot of times they get research or other benefits. They want to, you know, use those brokers to trade with.
So just back to Bruce's point, where for those separately managed accounts where the investment teams can kind of customize their guidelines, that really kind of puts the pressure back on the back office because then that becomes something out of the ordinary that the back office is programming into the compliance systems to make sure that we're monitoring all those compliance needs, you know, helping SISI in those regards. So as Joan had mentioned earlier, we do bring in all of the transactions and holdings into that data warehouse every night, and that is truly where we gather the information, or that's where the information is gathered or pulled from to prepare the reporting and other processes and procedures that we perform to make sure that the accounting records are appropriate or are accurate. We use several means to do that. Microsoft Access is a strong tool that we use, as well as our IT staff has built several internal applications that we utilize to do those types of things. We also maintain the calculation of the overall policy portfolio benchmark and the calculation of the value add of the actual portfolio versus that policy portfolio benchmark. In conjunction with the calculation of the investment performance returns for the managers, we also confirm each return with each external manager on a monthly basis. And this is critical to ensure that the proper amounts of fees, management, and incentive fees are being charged to the accounts. And it also is another way to confirm the valuations and the trade activity within each of those accounts. From an investment fund accounting perspective, We also provide the fund general ledgers to the Office of the Controller at UT System so they can record the fund activity into their accounting general ledgers. And we also work again with Terry Hall and the Texas A&M Treasurer's Office and their bond offering documents and rating agency requests just to get them any asset allocation exposure or any other type of information they might need for requests or reports.
Okay, well, and I'm going to continue on page 87 with another important of OAR's duties that you may not really realize that we do, and that relates to the accounting and reporting for all the individual endowments. You know, we mentioned earlier that there are over 12,000 endowments. It's 12,334 to be exact, and they keep growing. Most of these endowments are invested in the long-term fund, but some of them, there are some separately invested, and some of these endowments also have long-term fund units and other assets. And so we really do. We mentioned earlier, but to give you an idea, if we're running the long-term fund as a mutual fund, then we have to do all the shareholder and the participant accounting, and that's what we do. And the accounting part is done by, we mentioned IFAS, so that's what creates all the transactions. That's the processing system for us. And before we had IFAS, it was a mainframe process. And once we did IFAS...
You remember mainframes, right, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
It really did streamline...
Got one right here.
it streamlined a very cumbersome process. You know, when Bruce first got here, he asked us what we needed, and we told him we needed that mainframe replaced. So it only took us 2 years to convince him. But really, truly, that was an easy thing to do, to convert that mainframe processes into a secret process using this data warehouse stuff. We would have already done it. It was an extremely difficult process because not only were we entering stuff and sending it on to UT and UT Austin, UT Austin was also putting information in there. So it was a whole different way of looking at things. So it was a very big process. But I can't tell you how much time it saved. You know, we mentioned that long-term fund distributions and buy-in. When we handle all of that, of course, but when we used to have to do it through the mainframe, what would happen is you would do it, it would take all day, and then you would not see any reports until the next day when it came from paper from Austin. So it was about a stack that big. Now it's probably a couple of hours for us, so we were really fortunate that that all came along. So we do it for all these transactions, and everything has to go in, then it goes into our data warehouse. And I'll go into that a little bit more, because what happens now is we have the reporting part. We have two reporting systems, and they're actually accessed by all the UT institutions. The first one is CRIS, and you can go online and get almost anything you could possibly want from your endowment, and it's also at endowment level reporting, summary level reporting. So, for instance, somebody at UT Austin can pull up all their endowments, and they can sort them however they want. They can pull up, if they want the business school or whatever, they can do that as well. But if you're at UT Austin, you certainly can't see UT Arlington stuff. And if you're at the business school, you can't see the engineering school unless the institutions want that, because they control all of that. We've given them applications for them to be able to do that themselves. So it's extremely valuable for us. It saved us a lot of time, because now they can just go do whatever they want to do, and they don't have to call us. About the only time they do call us on some of this stuff is if they don't understand or if they want an enhancement to CRIS. So, because it's not a static system at all. In fact, 2 days ago we got another enhancement, and the IT team already got it in and it's pushed out. The other system that we have is called endowment reporting. What we do is we produce an endowment report. It's a two-page report. We produce these quarterly, 12,000 of them every quarter, and they have the activity. You can tell what beginning to the end of the year or the period. It'll have historical data of about 5 years. It'll also have a performance, and it'll have all sorts of other information. And the institutions actually send those out annually to all the donors. So if any of you have actually contributed to a UT system within dollars, you probably received one of those reports. I think Director Beck, I've shared that report with you, so some of you others might have it as well.
So now I'll move on to page 89, which lists some of the reports that we produce routinely. We prepare several reports daily, monthly, quarterly, and on an annual basis. And actually, as you can imagine, reporting takes up a good portion of our time. But fortunately, with the help of technology and our IT staff, we've become quite efficient in the preparation of those routine reports. It's actually the ad hoc report requests that probably are the most time-consuming and problematic. Those types of requests can come through from open records requests. More often than not, they come from Bruce or through Bruce from a board member, sometimes the night of before a board meeting. We always try to, you know, answer any question or provide any information that is requested. We never like to tell Bruce that we can't get any information. We very rarely do that.
Where do you... where's this warehouse physically located, and do you have a backup recovery policy, and do you exercise and test it?
We've got servers in here, and we're replicated to UT Arlington data center. So we've got two copies replicating in real time, and we're looking at performance.
So in the same city, though?
No. Arlington.
We did not have a backup until a couple of years ago. And Uche said, you know, we really ought to have a backup.
That's good.
And so now I'm
now, we did have a couple of Uche's team members load up their pickup truck and drive the equipment up there, but they made it. They stopped at a 7-Eleven, I think.
Don't tell us that story.
We got stories.
So on page 90 speaks to the back office involvement with the operational due diligence process. We started being involved in ops due diligence back in 2009.
These are our external managers.
On the external managers and for all of the different areas, NCC, LCC, and private investments. We've really concentrated our efforts on the upfront processes. We spend about 15 to 20 hours per manager for participation in the upfront process. A lot of the time is spent reading and kind of looking over the potential manager's controls and processes before we would participate in meetings or discussions to discuss any deficiencies or control risks that we might come across in that document review.
Do we have a third party that does some due diligence for us in terms of external managers, or that's all internally done?
It's all internally done.
We, on the hedge fund side, we've used Allburn, which does some part of what they'll consulting from, part of they'll do operational due diligence.
we'll read their, I mean, in some cases it can be 30, 40 page reports and compare to our own work. And to be clear, you know, we work together with Joan and Gary's team, together. And so then with Alborn, we feel like we have it buttoned up. But I mean, Alborn does some of the best work we've seen. But it's, they're not any better than what we do. So,
you ever make mistakes on managers that information comes to light that you just didn't know about?
For the back office? I mean, clearly on the investment side, there's been a couple.
That's a good question. That's a good question. On the operations side.
Yeah, all right. Only operations.
I'm trying to think.
Not that I'm aware of. No. I think things have come to light in our reviews that have been discussed with managers, and there have been agreements that were reached that they would resolve some of their issues or strengthen some of their processes based on.
When we've looked at prospective managers, we found some things that we didn't think were as good as they should have been, and they've concurred and either fixed it before we went in or agreed they were going to fix it, and we stay on top of that.
Okay.
And as Ryan said, I think since we've been involved, I think over the years the investment staff definitely has looked to us for more involvement. So it does seem to be adding some value to the process. So much so that we are currently we have an open position that we're trying to fill, and that person's full-time role will be the due diligence and ops.
And every 5 years, we'll go back on site and just.
Well, that's part of it. When we started it, it was just, let's do the new managers. And then it was like, well, wait a minute, let's recycle this.
Every 5 years.
Yeah.
So on page 91, the one last unique thing that we have to handle is our separately invested funds. So there's not that many separately invested funds that UTEMCO has to manage. There's about 100 of those, 60 or so are endowments, and the rest are in the charitable remainder trust. But, and so we handle all the receipts and disbursements with that, but we also have to handle the receipts and disbursements related to ones that we don't handle, and that is real estate, the Office of Real Estate at UT System handles, and of course the West Texas lands and the mineral interest. And these are on the individual endowments. So really what happens with us is, like the West Texas is going to send the receipts over, as well as the geology school, UT's Austin Jackson School of Geosciences, and that's an outlier because everything else comes from West Texas lands. So we have to make sure that we get those in the right accounts to identify them with the endowments. And then a lot of those dollars are just going to be reinvested into the long-term fund. And the other one that we do with the real estate, of course, the rents will come in, and we need to account for those as well, and they are a part of the endowment. So, for instance, I'm sure some of you know about the Brackenridge Tract. And if you drive down Lake Austin Boulevard, you know that there's the Randalls there as well as the 7-Eleven. So if you go to Chris and you go to our detailed records, you're going to see all of that information. So I was looking at it yesterday, and I could see rent from 1993. I could see the detail per month. So I don't know if anybody needs that type of information, but we have it. So, and all of it, like I said, it goes back to 1993. And we also have to make sure that we get all the valuations in this, too. We need to make sure that all these other securities are valued. And the reason that is because we need one place, because we're the subsidiary ledger. We need one place that we have everything related to those endowments. So you, without it, you can't have accurate reporting. So we act as subsidiary ledger. Actually, we're the subsidiary ledger for everything related to investments for UT System. And all that data has to get passed to them. And this is summary data. So if they need individual data, they go online and look at it.
The only thing is, as I spent more and more time with Gary and Joan and the team, one of the things that strikes me is when most people think about the back office for an investment management organization, they miss a lot of what these folks do for us, whether it's the cash system, the endowment report, accounting and reporting for 12,000 individual endowments, things like the operational due diligence, things like the separately invested funds, which isn't much money, but it's a full-time person, it's tax returns, whether it's things like the BRAC track. I mean, it's just a bunch of stuff that you didn't say you get to do, you said you have to do.
Yes, well, get to, have to, as long as I'm here, right? So Bruce mentioned the charitable remainder trust. Those are trusts that we have to do the tax returns for them. And those really are complicated. I mean, we, the Board of Regents are trustees for this. We have to look at the agreement. We have to make sure that we get those contributions when they're funded appropriately and right. I mean, it is very picky. Even from the date that they come in, we have to keep track of it. We do all the disbursements related for all of that. And then annually, we definitely have to do all their special reports that we have to do, and we have to file the tax returns. So in February and March, the team actually becomes kind of a small tax department. And I'm very comfortable with them. I have to sign every one of those returns, and I do, and I'm very comfortable with that.
Joan, just curious, what's the number on the CRTs? Ballpark.
We don't have that many. We're about 46, 47. Okay. You know, and now you actually the newer ones is we can get those to go into the long term fund. We used to couldn't do that, but now we can. So we've covered all of those critical functions. So if you look on page 92, you're going to see our efficiency. Well, in 96, we had 12 people. Today, we have 13. Gary said we had an opening. Assets under management went from about $9 billion to $36 billion. So that was about $750 million per person to about $2.8 billion. But, I mean, those are just dollars. So, but if you really think about everything that's happened along the way, there's so many more complexities that have come along. You know, we talked about it, and we talk about, you know, the PHF came here, and we created the GEF. There was a lot of work even when the PUF went from went to a total return fund when that constitutional amendment went. So all of this stuff has happened. And wherever our investment team goes, we follow. When they went into hedge funds in the 90s and the derivatives, now they think they have to go all over the world, so we just need to go with them. In all the co-investment, so we have to make sure that we handle whatever we need to do. And I think we do. And these are just really kind of a couple of examples of all of the complexities. So how did we do all this without changing, you know, adding a lot of staff? Well, really, when we first were doing this, it was a lot of weekends, a lot of nights. And at the same time, though, we were really working to build these systems with the IT team. And they have done a really, really good job for us. And just to let you kind of feel how much time it saved, you know, I mentioned those endowment reports. Way back when, we had to do about 100 of them on one special donor. And it took two of us about close to a month to get them done. So now there are 12,000 per quarter every quarter, and it probably only takes us a couple of hours to get them now because it's all programmed the way they are. And it just depends how fast we can check. But I will say, if something's wrong, that can be a problem. And, you know, that's why the expertise that we have in the staff is so important, because they're going to have to figure out why something's wrong manually. But that doesn't happen very often. So technology, of course, is just wonderful. We certainly are happy to have it. We certainly need the data warehouse. So before HA's arrival, and Bruce redirected the team, the IT team, we basically had the development staff to ourselves. And I want to just say, give recognition to two of those developers. Brent Dixon has been with UTAMCO. He's not here for 17 years. Katie Hollenbaugh has almost been here 16. She left for a little bit. She works part-time, although Uche would take her full-time if she would work for us full-time, but she hasn't. So we work closely with them. We still do. You know, even though Bruce said that we couldn't have them, we did sneak in a few things along the way, and one of those applications was related to performance attribution. That was a very time-consuming thing in Excel that we did, and now it's a lot quicker. It's still not easy, but it's a lot quicker. And we have a 3-page list, wish list for you that just keeps on growing. But I don't want to mislead anybody about all this complexity that we have and, you know, the staff. I do believe that as time goes on, I mean, we're probably kind of at our max, and there's a lot of work, and we would never want to put, you know, anything at risk. So speaking of staff.
Yeah, so now we're going to come to the most important part of the presentation. I'd like to introduce the staff. They're all congregated in the back corner of the room. There are three managers, myself, Debbie Childers, and Laura McCain. There are
six. Let's give him a hand.
Wait. We got everybody.
Everybody.
There are six members of the team that have been here since before UTEMCO started, around 25 years or longer in some cases. Joan and myself, Debbie Childers, Rebecca McManamy, who is a senior accountant. It has been great working with Rebecca. She is one that we always, a lot of times, say, give it to Rebecca because she can figure anything out and get anything done that we need her to get done. We also have Judy Wheelis, who works on the private investments. Over the years, the private investment team has turned over routinely, it seems. She has been the one constant with that portfolio. So the current private investment staff certainly know that if they need any historical information or find out history about those private investments, they would certainly go to Judy and work with Judy to get that. And then Karen Wiltrout is a senior operations specialist who has worked with us for many, many years. And she actually was here back in the day when we did do a lot of internal trading within the portfolios. So if you think about it, between these seven individuals standing here, there's about 150 years of institutional knowledge related to which is quite incredible. So one of our jobs currently is to try to make sure that the younger folks that I'm about to introduce kind of pick up that knowledge and can carry on the torch once we're gone.
It should be a long time from now.
We also have other members of the team that have been here close to 10 years. So Yvette Cal has been here for 10 years. Breanne Steele has been here a little over 9 years. And then we have Jared Urban, who's been here for 6 years. Our newest team members are Gwen Maldonado and Erin Corley. Unfortunately, we're about to lose Erin. She's moving to East Texas to be closer to her husband's family. Her last day is tomorrow, so we will be having an open position that we'll be looking to fill. And then our newest team member is Sherita Metzger, and she's been here a little over 3 months.
Does anybody have any questions for us? If not, I want to personally thank the staff because they are tremendous. I could not ask for a better staff. And since I'm supposedly in charge of it, I just couldn't do anything without them. And I appreciate all of their work that they do every day. And I remind Bruce every day.
Well, I'll make one comment. One, thank you very much. Very thorough. Your most impressive slide, maybe in the entire book, Bruce, is the efficiency. You've gone from 600K per employee to about $3 million of AUM, $3 billion per employee. So that's just great efficiency. Really, you guys are inspiring, and I can tell very committed to what you do. And, you know, so often we only focus on the investment professionals here, and so I will tell you, this place wouldn't work without all of you people. So thank you very much.
The organizational update will be very brief. Let's start with I think it's a nice segue to the technology update.
Talking about focus on the investment stuff. My presentation, by the way, can be found in tab 5 in Diligent and page 102 in the board book behind the organizational chart. As John and Gary mentioned earlier, before I got here, most of technology's focus was on operating accounting and operations and reporting area. Bruce asked us 3 years ago to focus on the investment team. At that time, we were long on the vision. We knew we wanted to aggregate our investment support information into a single location. We did some analysis, we looked at vendors out there, and we decided on a hybrid solution, and we bought a system that Globac built and wanted to customize it because it did not meet our needs at all, but it was a good place to start. Over the last 3 years, we made a lot of good progress. We've demoed several enhancements and systems for you over the past 3 years. We have made good progress on document management, data management, and we were about to start relationship management when we put a pause on the project to revalidate our priorities with our team. One of the things we went back to the investment teams and asked them how we're doing. We went to the firm and said, by the way, how are we doing in general? And one of the things we heard loud and clear was, at that point, top of their priority, given the way things have changed and the investment environment, was they wanted flexible, mobile, and offline access to investment information. They wanted to link all of our reporting across all of the systems. They wanted to be able to create and work on things when they're on planes. And by the way, John and Gary reminded us that we hadn't been paying them much attention in that 3 years. So we have to go back to the drawing board and figure out how to meet that challenge. Up to that point, we had spent, we spent $3.9 million on the system, and that was a cost of $2.4 million for the vendor and $1.5 million staff time, which we had to track through rating. What did we do? We looked at the vendor space to see whether we could build or buy the relationship management piece and merge it with all of the things that we built. Of all of the vendors that we looked at, we found one that was where we wanted to be and could get us there faster. So the decision was we presented, we recommended to Bruce and senior management at that point that we buy a new solution rather than continue building it as we were. And on the back of that, we're going to partner with a company called Dynamo, and we are going to spend the next year, by the end of next fiscal year, we will have that system in place, and it will have mobile access for our staff to be able to access the information offline as they requested. They'll be able to take notes, and as soon as they come back online, everything will sync up. And but most of all, it frees us to start working on the initiatives that we put on hold while we're trying to fix all the investment information issues over the past 2 years.
Ray, MIT is their primary user.
Oh, good.
So we had looked at them 3 years ago, and they didn't have what we needed, but they've made a tremendous amount of progress in the last 3 years.
We gave them feedback, and they went back and implemented all of the things, and they caught up with us.
So they listened.
Yeah. And we talked with Seth's folks, and we're very constructive on what
they have. Any other organizations?
There are others.
Staffel's looking at it.
But they've got others. They've got, you know, dozens of clients.
Oh, I was wondering how big they are. Okay.
They're based in Cambridge.
So what are we working on for the next year? We're going to work very hard to deliver the system for investment staff, consolidate the systems we have, and get it up and running as quickly as possible for them. We're going to start spending more time again with Joan and team and catch up on the things we've put on hold for the past 3 years. And we're going to start working on our users' highest value needs, and a lot of those are listed in front of you. And we're also going to work on technology.
And let me point out that in the latest security audit that System did, Uche and his team got a 99, which isn't 100, but is the highest score across all UT system. So we continue to get good grades on our security.
I'd like to give a shout out to our Chief Information Security Officer.
David, stand up. He's our Chief Information Security Officer.
Talking about continuity, David's been with the team since 93 as well. We've been here 91. So we have a lot of.
And then the only thing, other thing I'd mention on the UTEMCO update is you can see on the organization chart on page 100 in Diligent, there are a lot of red, which are open positions. We're actually making very good progress on filling a number of those positions. One person's accepted an offer. One person's about to accept an offer. We've got another couple of people. We're kind of in the final stages of diligence, so I think we were a little slow in getting started, but we're getting good momentum there.
Great, thank you. Anything else?
Lunch.
Okay, I think we will recess for lunch and reconvene at
1:15.
Yeah, let's do 1:15.